Hello, this is Dean Kernut, and welcome to the Alpha Exchange, where we explore topics in financial markets associated with managing risk, generating return, and the deployment of capital in the alternative investment industry. On this special Crisis Series episode of the Alpha Exchange, I had the opportunity to solicit the insights of Chris Cole, the founder and CIO of Artemis Capital. Through a framework that gives much weight to the impact of financial products and the risk-taking built around them, Chris has a unique understanding of both low and high periods of volatility and the linkages between them. In a paper authored in October 2017, Chris stated, quote, "The markets are not correctly assessing the probability that volatility reaches new all-time lows in the short term, VIX less than 9, and new all-time highs in the long term, VIX greater than 80, in 2018 to 2020. Incredibly, he was right on both counts as the VIX dipped below 9 in December of 2017 and recently reached a new all-time high close to 83, eclipsing the previous record from the GFC. He explains his thesis, shares his research on an optimal portfolio, his views on buying options at very high prices, and looks forward to what could be several years of a new, much higher volatility regime. This conversation gave me a great deal to think about, and I hope it does for you as well. Please be safe. My guest today on the Alpha Exchange is Chris Cole. He's the founder and CIO of Artemis Capital Management and someone who's traded a fair amount of vol over the years. Chris, it's great to have you back on and to have a deep conversation with you about the sheer force of moves that we're seeing in the markets these days. Thanks for coming on.
Well, thanks. It's great to be back on the show as well.
You and I talk a lot about volatility, and you've made your career of studying asset prices and volatility relationships. I'd just ask you to kind of step back and just give us your high level on the last month in terms of big picture observations, maybe what you observed about the setup coming into it. Obviously, this is a very unique event, but quite a forceful asset price reaction. What's top of mind for you?
Well, I think a couple of years ago, in 2017, I wrote that paper that talked about volatility and the alchemy of risk is the name of the paper. And it talked about volatility as being an input for risk taking and a source of excess returns in the absence of value. And how there was this $3 trillion short volatility trade out there that was both implicit and explicit. It represented various forms of taking risk on the assumption of stability for excess return in the absence of yield. And I think in that paper, at the very end of the paper, I kind of made a prediction where I sat back and I said, quoting it directly, "The markets are not correctly assessing the probability that volatility reaches new all-time lows in the short term," meaning VIX under 9 in 2017, "and new all-time highs in the long term," meaning VIX over 80, and that was explicitly written in the paper, sometime before the end of 2020. And that line has absolutely come true from that paper in 2017. We actually closed that December in 2017 with the VIX dropping below 9. And of course, this last March, we saw VIX jump over 80 for the first time since the 2008 financial crisis. And this was this idea of the Ouroboros of risk, this concept that volatility becomes an input into risk taking. This leads lower vol into lower vol. And when that cycle is broken, you can have higher vol break to even higher volatility. It leads into this dangerous reflexivity into this doom loop, much like a snake devouring its own tail. And, you know, you and I have been talking about this, all of its forms, for the past several years, really going all the way back, in some cases, to 2015. And what we saw in March was truly a violent, disorderly unwind of this multi-trillion dollar global short volatility trade. And I think this is a precursor to a new multi-year regime of higher volatility that we're likely to see going forward as markets begin to go through a very difficult deleveraging process.
You've done a great job of contextualizing some of the products that manufacture return in quiet markets. I'm thinking about just this coincidence of low rates and low vol at the same time as, in some ways, the setup for the perfect storm. And I think you've seen periods where rates have been low and vol has been high. So I'm thinking post the sovereign crisis in Europe in 2011, 2012. That's one example. Rates have been high and vol low as well, mid-90s. High rates, very low vol. Nothing really happened there either. Is it the case that this was in some ways the perfect setup for this reach for yield? And help us understand what that looked like in terms of the products that were maybe delivered to the end user. How were folks typically accessing this excess premium?
Yeah, so I think the excess premium comes from a combination of risk factors that are very similar to the risk factors one faces from a short vol portfolio. When you're short a portfolio of options, you're short vega, you're short the potential for volatility to rise, of course. You're short gamma, so gamma being the trend or the follow through of trend in market. You're short interest rates, so there's a big risk to interest rates rising. You're short liquidity. You face big liquidity risk if you have to cover your bets. And finally, you're short correlations. So when all assets sell off at the same time. So what we've been seeing is all of these financial engineering strategies either explicitly or implicitly have been assuming these risks of a short vol portfolio. And we saw the complete malfunctioning of all of those yield enhancement strategies this last March. One of the things you and I have been talking a lot about, for example, have been risk parity over the years. In a 2015 paper, I talked a lot about how stocks and bonds have spent more time correlated with one another over 200 years than anti-correlated. Well, one of the big problems that we saw that led to this disorderly unwind was the fact that bonds were actually selling, or U.S. Treasury bonds were actually suffering at the same time stocks were suffering. It was hammering these risk parity funds. So these big risk parity funds all had to delever at the same time. They were selling off stocks, bonds, and gold all at the same time, and they're all going out seeking search for an exit in a fire, and the exit was too small. In many ways, that took the Fed setting up, opening up massive liquidity lines in order for many of these multi-billion dollar funds to unwind these trades in an orderly fashion. We were naturally seeing a breakdown in correlations. Like risk parity is short correlation and it's short gamma. So those were two of those risk factors that were being exposed. Well, of course, we naturally saw various hedge funds that have been shorting tails that were short volatility fail. But I think one of the key things that most people have forgotten is a core risk is that short gamma exposure. And what I mean by that is there's this expectation that every single day that the market goes down, it'll rebound the next day. Well, what we saw was a failure of that expectation to materialize. The Fed would come on in, open up these liquidity lines, and the market would drop 5, 10% again. So you had this day after day after day, the market was down consistently over and over again. So this was hitting all of the aspects of the short volatility trade all at once. Short gamma, short volatility, short correlation, short liquidity, all of these risk factors were being hit at the same time. And it really took the Federal Reserve not only slashing rates, but opening up unprecedented liquidity lines for this trade, this big multi-trillion dollar global short volatility trade, to unwind in a way that didn't completely grind the entire financial system to a halt. Had the Fed not done that, we might have had multiple 1987s all at the same time on consecutive days.
I think you're spot on. And I think the height of this was, I want to say, the 18th or 19th of March. And you'd had a period of about a week where both the TLT and S&P were both down about 15%. Had the Fed not stepped in to be a buyer of last resort for the risk-free asset, there was even more disruption coming. And I'm just trying to disentangle the cause and effect, because there's no doubt that the market was hit with new news, an unbelievable, unimaginable sudden stop of the economy. It's never been that we've contemplated. There's been research on pandemics, but the markets never confronted it. Rightly so, markets, risk assets are down, correlations are up. But I'm curious, when you step back and you think about the new news versus the setup going in, is it the case you think that with a more robust system, this wouldn't have been nearly as bad? Is there a better preparedness that the system rightly could have had coming in?
Yeah, I think there's been a moral hazard with what has been done with monetary policy. And I think a lot of the fiduciaries, I'm just going to say it, have been negligent in understanding the long-term trajectory of the risks that they're taking. And I think that's, maybe that's an arrogant thing to say, and I don't mean to sound that way. I wrote a paper that came out earlier this year called Volatility and the Allegory of the Hawk and the Serpent. And I looked at all of these different asset classes over 100 years and suggested alternatives to the modern pension portfolio. And I back-tested all these financial engineering strategies, back-tested risk parity. I back-tested the 60-40 portfolio. I looked at everything you could possibly imagine that has been done in modern portfolio construction. It's like, how did these strategies perform over the Great Depression? How do they perform through stagflation? I came up with a alternative portfolio. And that portfolio is actually really quite shocking. But when you look at its performance over 100 years, it's the portfolio that consistently is able to produce risk-adjusted returns over 100 years of time. And that portfolio is roughly one-fifth exposure to stocks, one-fifth exposure to U.S. Treasury bonds, one-fifth exposure to gold, one-fifth exposure to trending commodities, and one-fifth exposure to volatility, active long volatility and long volatility strategies. And that portfolio is up 5% this year. So I wrote this paper before this crisis occurred, but using history to study, you look at this and say, okay, there's a way to insulate yourself from these risks without necessarily going out there and shorting vol and taking excessive short vol risk or long stability risk. And that's by having a true diversified portfolio. But it's really, really hard for many institutions to do something that's different like that, even though I think the efficacy of that type of portfolio has been borne out through this crisis, and I think will likely continue to be borne out over the next couple of years.
Well, there's really only one asset that has survived and truly thrived through this, and that's vol itself. Gold has hung in there. Obviously, rates, the treasury market has rallied quite a bit, but you did have that period where, as you pointed to, the correlations flipped and both of those got sold in a liquidation period. And so vol is this uniquely anti-fragile asset class. It's never the case in a crisis, and maybe you can comment on this, that someone looks at their portfolio and says, oh, wow, I'm more diversified than I expected to be. It's all these closet correlations. How should an institutional, someone who oversees institutional money, how should they think about putting these elements in their portfolio? What's the best way to secure diversification, especially through a period as volatile as this?
If anything, I think, you know, granted, I run an active long vol fund, and I've been talking about this for the greater part of a decade. So one has to consider the source here. But I think the research that I've done hopefully has shown why this makes sense from a mathematic and quantitative standpoint, that long volatility exposure is a necessity for the optimal portfolio. And those who have had it this past March have benefited greatly from that exposure. I don't think it's too late either. I don't think many people would realize this, but long vol actually carried positively between 1929 and 1942. You had, over the entire Great Depression and beyond, long volatility was actually a positive carry asset. It was not a negative carry asset. So in these periods of time where entropy is quite high and correlations are breaking down and there's a lot of confusion, long vol as an asset class can perform and can provide nonlinear protection for the rest of your portfolio. That anti-correlation is worth far more than excess return. A lot of times what people are searching for is they're looking for excess return. They're looking for things like private equity or something like that because they can get an extra X percent above equities. But what they fail to realize is mathematically, quantitatively, the excess return is not worth as much as anti-correlation. And long vol provides the most nonlinear payout and anti-correlated payout to your core risk factors. That becomes very apparent during a period of secular decline, such as the 1930s or the 1970s. And I believe we are entering into a period of potential secular decline where there is this massive deleveraging process that needs to occur. the market seems to be conflicted right now. The way the market's been behaving right now, it almost is talking about how this pandemic is a like a natural disaster. It's a one-off event. We now go back to normal. But I think what we were seeing even before the pandemic hit is global PMI was dropping, corporate debt to GDP, all-time highs, valuations at all-time highs. We were susceptible and going into a potential global recession even before the pandemic hit. Now that the pandemic has hit, all of the problems with too much corporate leverage, poor demographics, many of the problems with over-leveraged institutions, underfunded entitlement programs, all of these factors are going to gain steam. And this takes us into a very dangerous multi-year period of high entropy, high uncertainty in markets, very similar to the 30s, very similar to the stagflation of the 70s, and very, very similar to the period after 2008. And it's all occurring at a point in time where central banks, the efficacy of central bank policy has become less and less effective at the zero bound, something that also occurred in the 30s. So really, when you look at that setup, if you're an institution, you really need things that A, are anti-correlated and provide nonlinear exposure, that's vol, and B, something that can profit nonlinearly through the devaluation of fiat, and that's gold. And depending on who you are, maybe Bitcoin fits that framework if you're a smaller investor, maybe not an institutional investor. Historically, when you look at these periods of secular decline as we deleverage, gold and volatility are vital components of the portfolio. That's not my opinion. I lay out 100 years of history in the Volatility and the Allegory of the Hawk and Serpent paper. That's on our website. One can look at that. I have the numbers in there. Evaluate it yourself and come to your own conclusion. But I think those two asset classes become vital at this point in the cycle. And they're also two asset classes that most institutional investors, family offices, and individual investors have woeful allocations to. And that's sad because it almost guarantees we're going to face some sort of entitlement crisis and retirement crisis.
One of the things about vol is the entry point in terms of the price. So if you're buying vol at the end of 2017, of course, it's so low because the realize is even lower. But at least from a margin of error standpoint, you're buying something that's as close to its zeroth percentile as ever. Now you're buying vol that is carrying well, but it's very high nominally, and certainly at least potentially has the potential to come back down. Of course, as you say, that's set against a lot of new uncertainty. How should folks think about looking at option prices that are so much higher than they were even a month ago? And how should people get comfortable with the risk of buying implied vol when it's this high?
I think there's two things to think about on that. I think the first is this idea that volatility is an asset class that can be valued like any other asset class, and that there's tremendous benefit from active management of long vol. So the way that Artemis trades volatility, it's not like we just buy a bunch of options and hold them. There's a dynamic process for valuing and ensuring that we can carry that volatility in a way that's effective that we undergo every single day. To that process as well, I think one of the things that people dramatically underestimate is how long volatility can remain elevated during periods of economic uncertainty and high risk. We are so used to this idea that vol spikes, it drops, and then it's over. We forget that in a period like the 1930s, volatility averaged over 35 on a realized basis for close to a decade. We saw volatility remain over 30 for long periods of time between the late 60s and 70s. And obviously, you had tremendously high volatility remain elevated in the period of 2007 all the way to 2011. In a period of secular decline, what we typically see is a 3 to 5 year period of elevated volatility. And to this point, definitely we look at VIX today, which is around 46, but you can buy long dated forward vol at 30, and you can roll up forward vol term structures effectively at different points. So there's ways to play that. There is ways for active managers to work with that to minimize the cost of carry. And also to understand that when vol remains elevated, it stays elevated for very long periods of time, really is a 3 to 5 year regime. So I think people need to avoid thinking about volatility as a one-off play and think about it as an asset class that they can use during this kind of 3 to 5 year period of high entropy and high risk as markets delever. It does take, it's not something that you can just go in and do and buy and not actively manage. It requires active management the same way that a long short equity fund requires active management, the same way that a credit fund requires active management. You can't just passively buy long vol. It takes expertise. The other thing that I think people don't realize about long vol is that most of the money is made through gamma. Everyone thinks vega is the primary driver, but actually the gamma effect is a key driver that can be exploited. And one of the things that we saw is that a long vol portfolio as modeled through a period like the Great Depression, as modeled for a period like the 70s, made more money off of that gamma, the long gamma effect, than it made money from the vega effect. Of course, you can do that through other means other than options, like commodity trend advisors have that gamma effect to it. I think that's really important to realize as well. It's not just the vega component, but the gamma or the trend effect that can provide some of the nonlinear gains for long vol.
You make a great point on short dated vol. And of course, the VIX is a implied vol measure for 1 month options. It's reached a new all time high. I'd love to get your thoughts just as an expert on the VIX and its characteristics of skew and term structure. One observation that I had seen from a couple of weeks ago was that the May 40-130 strangle in the VIX had a value of $6, which I found just absolutely remarkable. I want to say the VIX was probably in the 60s at the time. Through this period of dislocation, what have been your main observations on the VIX itself and all the products built around it and its kind of surface of vol and term structure, the skew and term structure?
I think it's an exciting time because it reflects as entropy rises and there's more turbulence across markets and there's dislocations, this provides tremendous opportunity for vol arbitrage and being able to find ways to buy and carry volatility in a very smart way. So from a vol perspective, this represents probably one of the most interesting periods of time. I mean, you really have to go back to pre-2011 to see opportunities like this in vol markets and inefficiencies like this. I believe that this is not a one-off. I believe it's the type of opportunity set that will last for a couple of years. It's not just the pandemic, but it's also the fact that the pandemic is an event that is accelerating a recession and deleveraging process that was likely already going to take place. And because of that, I think we're seeing extreme dislocations that we haven't seen with the exception of periods like 2008, 1987, and the 30s. I think that presents a lot of interesting opportunity in vol trading and in finding ways, in creative ways and smart ways, to own volatility and own convexity in ways that minimize the cost of carry, despite the optically high level of where the VIX might be at any point in time.
You've done a great job contextualizing and sizing this vol ecosystem. And one of the characteristics of this short vol trade, I think that was important over time, was not just that it made money, but it did so with such consistency. This vol risk premium was a consistent moneymaker. And as you referenced, the gamma element, the absolute explosion of realized, has caused huge losses in a lot of these strategies. When you think about the capital that was previously committed to accessing this vol risk premium that has likely experienced substantial losses, how much capital do you think has been impaired? And what is the kind of new system of risk-taking look like in this sphere of risk-taking in vol risk premium harvesting? What does it look like relative to what it was, say, 3 to 6 months ago?
What's fascinating is, and you've done some great work on this in your writing, which I very much enjoyed, is I think the idea of the so positive and now has swung to be almost consistently negative. And to people who don't know what that means, it's almost like a rubber band. When the dealer gamma is really positive, it enforces mean reversion and enforces low volatility. And now the dealer gamma has gone quite negative. We have a framework where the rubber band has like, it snaps in one direction. And that's why we have these down 7% moves in the S&P and up 7% moves in the S&P, because you end up having a reinforcement in the direction that the S&P is moving. That's the way that markets used to be prior to the 1970s. You used to have this very strong autocorrelation effect. I'm going to talk about that at length in my paper. We have gotten so used to the opposite of that, this mean reversionary effect, where every single day, if the S&P is up a little bit, it comes back. Even if it's down, it gets bid back up. Now we're seeing the exact opposite, where if the market is up at the beginning of the day, it's likely to be up big by the end of the day. And if it's down at the beginning of the day, it's likely to be down big by the end of the day. And each incremental day, you end up having, if yesterday was down, tomorrow is likely to be down, and vice versa. So you're having this reinforcement of the price trend in whatever direction it's moving in. And that is something that has radically changed, that radically changed in March. And it represents something that is really worth watching, because so much of the global short volatility trade has been predicated on this expectation of mean reversion. And now all of a sudden, you're having this massive failure in mean reversion. And a failure in mean reversion can mean that any trend is amplified in any direction. It's the uptrend or the downtrend. But I think what a lot of people don't think about, so much was made about the fact that vol was staying elevated, or the VIX was staying elevated, even though the S&P was rebounding. Well, when you have days like we had yesterday where the S&P is up 7% on the day, that is reinforcing high vol. All it takes is moves of 4% a day for VIX to be justified at a 60 level. So when you're having consistent moves of 4 to 10% in either direction, that is justifying elevated volatility. You can even make the argument that vol might be underpriced at 40, given some of these moves. And I think the nature of those extreme moves is being amplified by the fact that these pillars of mean reversion, things like the dealer gamma that has suddenly gone negative, all of a sudden you have this pillar of mean reversion removed, corporate share buybacks, this major multi-trillion dollar pillar of mean reversion, these debt finance share buybacks removed, gone. That has been responsible for upwards of a third of the S&P price gains over the last several years by RMS Research. So you remove these pillars and all of a sudden you go from a mean reversionary market to a trending autocorrelated market. And that is a key shift that I am watching and paying a lot of attention to. And it goes back to that idea that it's not just Vega, that if you're long volatility, you're not just profiting off of Vega, you're profiting off of gamma or trend. And I think that's something that a lot of people don't take into consideration or think that deeply about.
These are such great points. And I was looking at since the period right before the crisis, call it 2007, I was looking at the top 50 up moves in the S&P, 9 of which have happened in the last month. The 5-day realized on the S&P, so this is the last 5 days, which are well past the height of the dysfunction when treasuries were selling off as well. The 5-day is 67, and it more than justifies where the VIX is at this point in time. And I think also your point on buybacks is so important. These are a stabilizing force in markets, as Bill Gross used to call it, corporate QE, sometimes involving the explicit and quite large sale of optionality into the market through ASRs. And you just wonder, again, what this new landscape looks like of impaired capital, much wider margins of error. It just, you can't count on these relationships anymore. And it's just, to me, I agree with you on the market clearing price of vol continuing to stay very elevated.
It's a fascinating idea that so much has been predicated on mean reversion. We are seeing a wholesale failure of mean reversion. And that actually is going to spell problems for a lot of institutions. If this continues, it'll spell problems for a lot of institutions that have not calibrated their portfolio to profit from gamma, autocorrelation, and correlation breakdowns. And people say this is unprecedented. Actually, it's really not unprecedented, because if you go back and you study the 1929 to 1935, a lot of the same problems, we encountered a lot of the same problems during that period of time. And you had a market that went from very mean reversionary to very autocorrelated very, very quickly. And the other thing that people really forget is we were also pressing towards the zero bounding rates at that point in time. So if you look at strategies like risk parity, and if you backtest them back to the 30s like we have, they didn't do very well in the 1930s. They weren't catastrophic, but you didn't do much better than a 60-40 portfolio, particularly on a risk-adjusted basis. And risk parity didn't protect you from huge drawdowns during that period of time. It makes perfect sense, because all of a sudden interest rates are at the zero bound and you have no other means of getting convexity into your portfolio or defensive aspects, you're going to struggle. And then you're particularly going to struggle if markets remain autocorrelated on the way down. I think these are some of the kind of existential questions that if you're a retail investor, I think you have to look at very seriously. If you're an institutional investor and a fiduciary, I think it's vital. We've done an extensive 100-year research study. It's available right on my website for people who want to take a look at that, to look at some of these relationships. And we publish our data in that as well. I don't hold back. It's all there in the math. It's not opinions. It's just simple math and empirical data. And people can make their own judgment on it.
Well, Chris, I appreciate you spending some time today talking about these important topics. And of course, for our country and the world, let's hope that we get our arms around this very difficult situation. And I agree with you that it's an opportunity to step back and think about what the next 10 plus years might look like in terms of asset management. It's not like the last 10, that's for sure. So Chris, thanks again for being a guest. We appreciate it, and please be well.
Thank you as well. And I definitely wish you and your family best of health. And of course, the best of health to all the viewers at home. I think everyone is dealing through a variety of different crises at this point. Markets are one thing, but I think people's health and well-being is the most important thing.
Well said. I'll talk to you soon, Chris.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Alpha Exchange. If you've enjoyed the show, please do tell a friend. And before we leave, I wanted to invite you to drop us some feedback. As we aim to utilize these conversations to contribute to the investment community's understanding of risk, your input is valuable and provides direction on where we should focus. Please email us at feedback@alphaexchangepodcast.com. Thanks again, and catch you next time.